Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
There's a story that once upon a time in New Orleans, there was a Creole gentleman who had a daughter of surpassing beauty. While still a teenager, the young woman caught the eye of a wealthy older man. Now, the man was old enough to be the girl's grandfather, but that didn't stop him from pursuing her relentlessly. The young woman was decidedly less enthusiastic about this geriatric suitor, and time again, she rejected his proposals of marriage. If the suitor's advanced age wasn't enough, the girl had already given her heart to another man, a young man her own age, who had just left New Orleans to seek his fortune in the Caribbean. He had vowed to her that when he made enough money, he would return and they would be married. But the girl's father was concerned. This wealthy older suitor was potentially the family's ticket out of the poorhouse. If the father could make this match, their many financial woes could disappear. So the father started to advocate on behalf of the wealthy older man. Maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea if the girl got married to him. I mean, he seems nice enough. And besides, the guy is loaded. The young woman was hearing none of this and dug in her heels. There was no way she was going to marry this old creep. Enraged, her father decided to take things to the next level. He locked his daughter in a cabin by Lake Pontchartrain, where nightly the old man would turn up and would take a new swing at wooing her. She always refused. The desperate father even started threatening and beating the girl to get her to accept the proposal. But the strong-willed young woman steadfastly insisted that she would sooner die than marry some lecherous senior citizen. With nowhere else to turn, the girl's father and the old suitor sought out the only person in New Orleans who might be able to help them, the voodoo queen, Marie Laveau. When the men approached Laveau, she explained that if they paid her price and followed her instructions exactly, then she guaranteed that the wedding would take place. The men agreed, and Marie Laveau started cooking up some voodoo. Marie Laveau gave the father love potions with the instruction to mix them secretly into the girl's food. The old man was given a gree-gree bag containing the crushed genitals of a black cat. The old man was told to hang the bag off his belt to bring back his youthful virility. Finally, Laveau gave the men the strict instruction to leave the girl alone for exactly 2 weeks. The father could bring her the magically dosed food, of course, but the relentless courting needed to stop. So, the men did exactly as Marie Laveau said. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, the girl emerged from the lakeside cabin, looking pale and sickly, but saying that she would accept the proposal and would marry the old man. Well, the father and the old man were both overjoyed. Preparations were made quickly, and a mere 2 weeks later, a giant wedding ceremony was held at New Orleans' St. Louis Cathedral. That night, the cream of New Orleans society was invited back to the old man's mansion, where he hosted an elaborate wedding reception. At the mansion, champagne flowed, and the guests feasted on rare delicacies. Lips wagged about the couple's scandalous age difference, but hey, a good party was a good party. The time finally came for the couple to have their first dance. The crowd assembled, and the hired musicians began to play a waltz. The groom took his bride by the hips, and for a moment, he seemed young again. He started to dance with a grace and vigor few people thought he still possessed. But then, suddenly, the man's breathing started to sputter. His face turned red, then purple, and then he crumpled to the ground. A physician in the crowd ran to the man's side, but it was too late. His heart had stopped. The old man was dead. The young bride was now a widow, and so she inherited the old man's entire vast estate. So, after burying her late husband, the young widow then sent for her adventurous boyfriend in the Caribbean. He returned to find his old sweetheart rich beyond her wildest dreams. The two married and lived happily ever after. When asked about her role in the whole strange affair, Marie Laveau apparently smiled a sly-looking smile and said, "I promised that there would be a wedding." And there was a wedding. Man, what a great story. In fact, that might be my favorite Marie Laveau legend, mostly because it has such a satisfying twist. Like many Marie Laveau stories, it starts out in this morally ambiguous place. The girl is being beaten and forced into a horrible marriage, and then when Marie Laveau enters the story, she seems to be helping the bad guys. But of course, by the end, it becomes clear that the magic of Marie Laveau serves a higher purpose. Now, this story is also a pure invention. There's absolutely no proof that any of that happened. I know sometimes stories on this show can be based on a scrap of truth, but this one barely has a scrap. This tale seems to have been the invention of 20th century writers based on loose oral traditions that most of Marie Laveau's magical work had to do with love potions and matchmaking. But all the fairy tale-like details in that damsel in distress story seem to have been the product of a storyteller's imagination. This is what scholars who have seriously studied Marie Laveau like to call the quote-unquote Laveau legend. The Laveau legend is a mishmash of rumor, hazily recalled memories, and straight-up historical fiction that has been mistaken for proper history writing. The popularity of this legend has meant that, ironically, one of New Orleans' most famous residents is easily one of the least understood. But when the verifiable historical facts about New Orleans' best-known voodoo priestess are so few, can you really blame people for leaning into the legend? Is there any truth to be had when examining the life of Marie Laveau? Let's find out today on Our Fake History. Episode number 119, Who Was the Voodoo Queen of New Orleans? Part 2. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast where we explore historical myths and try and determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we are continuing our look at the famous voodoo practitioner, the great and mysterious Marie Laveau. But before we jump back into that story, I just want to take a minute and remind everyone that Dirty Church, the band that brings us the OFH theme song every week, has a new EP currently available at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. So if you've been following along, then you know that I've been playing a new Dirty Church song at the end of each show for the past three shows. Well, today is the last one, so if you're trying to collect them all, then please listen right to the end of the show today to hear a brand new song from Dirty Church. Or you can just skip ahead to it right now if you're that excited to hear it. But it'll be there at the end of the show, and go to dirtychurch.bandcamp.com if you want more music from that band. All right. Now, as I'm sure you've already put together, this is part two of what is going to be a trilogy on Marie Laveau. Yep, this one became a trilogy too. I just can't help myself. Now, if you haven't listened to part one, then you may want to go back and give that a listen now. In part one, I did my best to introduce the wildly different ways in which Marie Laveau was remembered by the people of New Orleans. I tried to give some context around Marie Laveau's complex racial identity and the racial politics in general in colonial and antebellum Louisiana. I also looked at Marie Laveau's first marriage, the tales associated with her start as New Orleans voodoo queen, and the curious story of how she got her famous house on St. Ann Street. Now, I set up a whole lot in that first episode, so really, if you haven't listened to it, check it out. But one thing I haven't really explained in much detail yet is voodoo itself. Voodoo is often caricatured as a backwards superstition or a nefarious form of black magic. But the truth about voodoo is infinitely more complex. Today, I want to take some time and explore what voodoo actually is, and how Marie Laveau fits into this unique tradition. So without any further ado, let's dive in. So what is voodoo? Well, as a rule, voodoo defies easy explanation and categorization. This is because it's a religious tradition that doesn't have a holy book or a code of orthodoxy. Voodoo is something that is passed on from person to person. The practices are transmitted orally or are experienced and then repeated. As such, voodoo practice varies greatly between different parts of the world and different moments in history. So, my explanation is going to be imperfect. I'm going to do my best to give you a good sense of this, but given our time constraints, there's just no way I could express the multitude of traditions that make up what is voodoo. So, you know, by all means, go out and learn more. But in a nutshell, voodoo is a unique combination of traditional West African pagan beliefs and Roman Catholicism. This is what scholars of religion call syncretism, which is your $10 word of the day, syncretism. Syncretism refers to a mashing up of different religious traditions to create some new form of worship. Voodoo is a syncretic religion. The roots of voodoo come from West Africa, specifically the regions that were most heavily affected by the transatlantic slave trade. These are places like Benin, Ghana, Togo, Nigeria, and Senegal. A big part of voodoo worship comes out of the traditional forms of religion that you find in those countries. Now, at the risk of oversimplifying, these traditions include beliefs in animal spirits, the spirits of powerful ancestors, and a pantheon of gods. Some West African people, specifically those living in and around what is today Benin, believed in a family of gods known as the Orishas. The Orishas were kind of like the ancient Greek gods, so if you know your ancient Greek pantheon, the Orishas weren't all that different. Like the Greek gods, each Orisha had their own duty or power. There was a god of war, a god of metalwork. There was even a god in charge of crushed cassava, which was an important food in that region. Now, voodoo takes the Orishas and a whole bunch of other West African beliefs and combines them with certain Catholic practices. Most voodoo practitioners believe in the Christian God and Jesus, but most important to voodoo is the worship of the saints. Now, this mashup occurred as the result of the slave trade and Catholic missionary activity in West Africa. It's been speculated that slaves brought to Louisiana and the French colony of Saint-Domingue, later Haiti, continued practicing their traditional West African religions. However, to get them past the white authorities, they coated them with a Christian veneer. The added elements of Christianity may have been a type of camouflage, but they also may have come out of the sincere beliefs of practitioners. It's hard to know. But eventually, the religious practice evolved to the point where it was neither simply a pagan West African religion nor an offshoot of Roman Catholicism. Voodoo was something entirely its own. Now, as I already mentioned, in different parts of the world, you find different kinds of voodoo. In West Africa, there's a voodoo tradition, although it's sometimes called Vodon, or Vodou, or Voodoo. Most experts believe that the West African variant of the religion tends to resemble pre-contact African beliefs more than any other variety of voodoo. Many Caribbean islands have their own local take on the practice as well. There's Puerto Rican voodoo, usually spelt V-U-D-U. In Cuba, they have Santeria. But the place most associated with the development of voodoo, or vodou, is Haiti. Haitian voodoo is characterized by a belief in an elaborate pantheon of spirits known as Loa. Scholars of religion point out that many of these Loa seem to have been imported from West Africa. In fact, some of the Loa seem kind of similar to the West African Orishas. The belief is that there is a creator god of the universe, and that is the god in the Bible. In Haiti, they often refer to him as Bon Dieu, which in French just means the good god. However, it's believed that Bon Dieu doesn't involve himself much in human affairs, at least not the day-to-day stuff. So if you need help with something more worldly, you can either petition the Catholic saints or this group of spirits known as the Loa. The way you get a Loa's attention is through various prayers and homemade charms, but also through ceremonies that involve dance and sometimes animal sacrifice. One of the best known Loa in the Haitian tradition is a figure known as Baron Samdi, Lord of the Graveyard. Baron Samdi is often presented as a man, or a skeleton, wearing a black top hat and a tuxedo. He's meant to resemble a corpse about to be buried in the traditional Haitian style. Now, Baron Samdi is often made the poster boy of voodoo because he's such a recognizable character. Aside from being the spirit that guides the dead to the afterlife, he's also a bit of a trickster figure and is associated with worldly vice. As such, he's usually depicted drinking rum and smoking a big cigar. So, as you might have guessed, he makes for a great Mardi Gras costume. I bring him up not only because he's interesting, but because he's an example of how this tradition has evolved over time. Baron Samedi is similar to the West African god of the dead, but so much about him is distinctively New World. Now, there's a lot of debate around how much Louisiana voodoo was influenced by Haitian voodoo. No doubt, there was contact between these two places and a sharing of religious practice. But people of West African descent in Louisiana seem to have developed their own distinct take on voodoo. The Louisiana form of voodoo has a decidedly more Catholic flavor than its Haitian and West African counterparts. In the Louisiana form of voodoo, there seems to be less emphasis placed on the Loa, although they do pop up. Instead, more focus is placed on Catholic saints. A great way to illustrate this difference is by looking at the figure of Papa Legba. In Haitian voodoo, Papa Legba is a Loa who is associated with gates, fences, and the transition between spaces. He's considered the intermediary between people and the spirit world. He stands at the crossroads. In Haiti, when you begin a voodoo ritual, often the first Loa to be called upon is Papa Legba. Now, in Louisiana voodoo, this figure is often worshipped in the form of Saint Peter. In Christian belief, Saint Peter has a very similar function. He was called Petros, or Rock, because Christ said that he would be the rock on which he built his church. The church is the intermediary between people and God. And any of you who have seen a Bugs Bunny cartoon know that Saint Peter is thought to sit at the gates of heaven and decide who gets in. You know, kind of like Papa Legba. The point is that in Louisiana voodoo, praying to the saints, going to church, and participating in what many would consider typical Catholic practice is a more pronounced part of the religion. You're more likely to pray to Saint Peter than call on Papa Legba. Interestingly, Denise Alvarado, author of The Magic of Marie Laveau, has argued that Marie Laveau herself may have been responsible for many of these distinctive elements in Louisiana voodoo, including its more heavily pronounced Catholicism. Alvarado's gone so far as to refer to New Orleans-style voodoo as, quote, Laveauan voodoo. You see, for many, part of the mystery around Marie Laveau was the fact that she was often described as a devout Catholic who went to church multiple times a week. Many asked, how could such a pious Catholic also be the queen of the voodoos? Well, Alvarado explains that for Marie Laveau, these two practices would not have been seen as inconsistent or contradictory. Both the Catholic Church and voodoo rituals would have been seen as a way to contact the divine. According to Alvarado, the church was voodoo, and voodoo was part of the church. One did not disqualify the other, at least in the mind of voodoo practitioners. As such, if someone came to Marie Laveau for help or counsel, she was just as likely to tell you to go to church and pray to the saints as she was to hand you a specially prepared gri-gri bag that might entice some spiritual help. But when trying to determine what Marie Laveau's voodoo rituals were actually like, historians are once again stuck with the unenviable task of parsing through deeply unreliable sources. Our understanding of Marie Laveau's rituals come from either hazy remembrances of the people interviewed by the Louisiana Writers Project in the 1930s, or highly exaggerated tales of voodoo rituals that appeared in newspapers, cheap periodicals, and what passed for magazines in the 19th century. So, if we're going to understand this at all, we're going to have to look at examples of both. So let's start by looking at the more sensationalist literature. Articles about voodoo in the 19th century were usually written by white writers who claimed to have spied on a voodoo ritual or attended a voodoo ritual in disguise. The goal of these articles was to both titillate the reader and disparage the black and mixed race populations allegedly involved in these rites. In the lead-up to the American Civil War, these descriptions were used as a means to justify new and more restrictive laws governing the slave population. In the Reconstruction era, sensationalist descriptions of voodoo rituals were often connected to recently elected black politicians who had just been granted the right to run for office. More often than not, these black politicians had absolutely nothing to do with the voodoo ritual in question. But the message being sent was quite clear. One should not trust a black politician because voodoo is freaky. Oh, brother. The descriptions in these news articles always played up the most exotic and erotic elements of voodoo ceremony. The authors would often editorialize throughout, throwing in comments about how dreadful and sinful everything was. These articles would almost always describe the rituals as ending with a massive orgy. If we were to take these articles at face value, then we might conclude that group sex was a huge part of New Orleans voodoo. Now, most experts are skeptical of these orgy stories, as it's not something you see in modern voodoo practice. Most believe that these stories were specifically designed to shock readers and slander voodoo practitioners. So, although these articles are some of the only sources we have when it comes to 19th century Louisiana voodoo, we shouldn't approach them like they're some form of sober reporting. These are sources that need to be handled with care. So, what do they sound like? Well, let's take a look at one. Historian Carolyn Merrill Long points to this description, taken from an 1875 article by one Marie B. Williams. The article is called A Night with the Voodoos. The author tells us that the account originally came from one Professor D. of New Orleans, a pseudonym taken by some well-known local. The account was supposedly something that Professor D. witnessed as a teenager in 1822. The presiding priestess at this voodoo ritual is identified as Senite Dede. Senite Dede was a Marie Laveau-like figure who may or may not have actually existed, as nothing can be found in the archival record to substantiate her ever living in New Orleans. So, right off the bat, we've got a bunch of question marks. Now, before we dive into this, I just want to give everyone a heads up that this is another one of those passages that uses some outdated and racist language, so be warned. Marie B. Williams tells us that in 1822, young Professor D. was taken to an abandoned brickyard where he witnessed the following. Quote, "By the light of bonfires and torches, the youth could see about 60 people dressed in white, males and females, old and young, negroes and negresses, and some mulatresses and quadroons, and half a dozen white men and two white women." End quote. In the middle of the congregation, Professor D. saw a long table serving as an altar, with two taxidermied cats on either end, a black cat on one end and a white cat on the other. In the middle of the altar, he saw a cypress sapling. Quote, "Immediately behind the cypress was a black doll with a dress variegated with Kabbalistic signs and a necklace of the vertebrae of snakes around her neck, from which depended an alligator's fang encased in silver." End quote. From there, Professor D. spotted a man he recognized, an older black man named Zozo, who seemed to be the musical director and master of ceremonies for the evening. He directed events with beats from a large drum. Quote, With two sticks, he droned away with a monstrous ra-ra-ta, ra-ra-ta-ta. It was a queer sound to this satanic discord. End quote. Then entered the possibly fictional voodoo priestess Sanité Dédé. Quote, she was evidently the high priestess or voodoo queen. She made Kabbalistic signs over the initiates and sprinkled them vigorously with some liquid from a calabash in her hand, muttering under her breath. She raised her hand and Zozo dismounted his cylinder, and from some hidden receptacle in or behind the large black doll drew an immense snake, which he brandished wildly aloft. He talked and whispered to it. With every word, the reptile, with undulating body and lambent tongue, seemed to acknowledge the dominion asserted over it. Zozo now compelled the snake to stand upright for about 10 inches of its body, and its head was horizontally laid. In that position, Zozo passed the snake over the heads and around the necks of the initiates, repeating at each pass the words which constitute the name of this African sect, Voodoo Mangnian. End quote. The author goes on to describe a bacchanalian feast washed down with large quantities of wine. She also punctuates the whole description with reminders that all of this is very sinful and the participants are quite evil. She speaks derisively of African people, calling some of the attendants, quote, the oldest and ugliest of the tribes of Congos, end quote. The article climaxes with the author breathlessly describing a very sexual dance. Quote, the beat of the drum and the thrum of the banjo swelled louder and louder. Under the passion of the hour, the women tore off their garments and almost nude went on dancing. No, not dancing, but wriggling like snakes. The orgies were becoming frightful. End quote. Finally, we're told that Professor D summed up the evening like this. Quote, if I have ever realized a sense of the real visible presence of His Majesty the Devil, it was that night I spent among his voodoo worshippers. End quote. Okay, so what do we do with this source? The style of writing is so sensational. The author really makes a meal out of describing wriggling snakes and wriggling bodies. When she's not titillating her readers with hedonistic descriptions, the author is making these shocked-sounding asides about how this is all so horrible, which, you know, to me, really feels like feigned disgust, given how juicy all of her descriptions are. So, I mean, it goes without saying that this is deeply unreliable. And yet, the descriptions of the dancing, the altar, and the snake routine do seem reminiscent of real voodoo rituals. Experts point out that you can see similar rituals performed in Haiti today. So, while we really need to take this with a grain of salt, scholars like Carolyn Merrill Long think that this may have been based on a real experience. Based on, you know, not accurate reporting, but based on. So, it's possible that Marie Laveau's rituals may have looked something like this. But thankfully, we do have other descriptions from potentially more reliable sources. These are the remembrances of the people interviewed by the Louisiana Writers Project. That was the Depression-era project I spoke about in the last episode that led to dozens of old New Orleanians being interviewed about their memories of Marie Laveau. So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, let's look at what those sources tell us about Marie Laveau's rituals. Thanks to the interviews conducted by the Louisiana Writers Project in the 1930s, historians have a number of first-hand accounts about Marie Laveau. Some of the most compelling recollections came from an informant named Marie Dédé. And yes, there is more than one person named Dédé in this week's episode. Marie Dédé was born in 1866 and claimed to have been close friends with Marie Laveau's grandchildren. She told the Louisiana Writers Project that as a child, she used to play in Marie Laveau's house on St. Ann Street, and every now and then she would peek into the rooms that contained Laveau's voodoo altars. This is what she remembered. Quote, "Marie Laveau had so many candles burning, I don't see how that house never caught on fire. She had all kinds of saints' pictures and flowers on the altar. In this room, Marie also had a big statue of Saint Anthony, and she would turn him upside down on his head in her yard when she had work to perform. Then they would come to me and say, 'Come see, my grandma got Saint Anthony on his head.' And Marie Laveau would put us children out and lock the gate." End quote. Another informant, Charles Raphael, also claimed to have seen Marie Laveau's altar. He said the altar in her front room was, quote, "intended for good luck charms, money-making charms, and husband-holding charms. On this altar, she had a statue of St. Peter and St. Moron," end quote. St. Moron being a saint particular to New Orleans. He was represented as a dark-skinned person, or sometimes as a dark-skinned version of St. Anthony. He was considered the patron saint of runaway slaves. If St. Anthony helped people who lost things, St. Moron helped people who had gotten lost on purpose. Now, notice how these descriptions differ from the night with the voodoos. Laveau's voodoo was far more rooted in saint worship. Now, I'm sure some of you are curious about Marie Laveau flipping Saint Anthony on his head. That practice actually comes from European magical traditions. In those traditions, inverting the natural order or flipping certain sacred symbols is seen as a way to contact the spirit world. You take the holy thing, you mess with the holy thing, you unlock a portal. The descriptions in A Night with the Voodoos focused heavily on the distinctively African attributes of voodoo. But these remembrances of Marie Laveau seem to describe a practice far more rooted in Catholicism and European magic. But notably, Charles Raphael also remembered that Marie Laveau had a second altar in her house that was for less savory affairs. He reported that she had, quote, "an altar for bad work, where she prepared charms to kill, to drive away, to break up love affairs, and to spread confusion. It was surmounted by statues of a bear, a lion, a tiger, and a wolf," end quote. So, if we believe Charles Raphael's recollection, then perhaps Marie Laveau's practice wasn't all Catholic saints and good luck charms. He remembers there being a dark side. Now, one of the most detailed descriptions of a voodoo ceremony hosted by Marie Laveau also comes from the Louisiana Writers Project. This interviewee claimed to have witnessed one of Marie Laveau's rituals firsthand, reporting, quote, "there was a big chair, like they use in church for the bishop, and Marie sat in it at the opening of the meeting. Then she would tell the people to ask for what they want, sprinkle them with rum, and start the dances. I have seen those men turn the women over like a top. They had large handkerchiefs that they would put around the women's waist, and would they shake? There were more white people at the meetings than colored. The meeting lasted from 7 to 9 o'clock, and they would have things to eat and drink." End quote. Now, I found it interesting that that description, though considerably less scandalous, has a number of elements in common with A Night with the Voodoos. There's a voodoo queen anointing the congregation with rum. There's wild dancing. There's a feast. However, This description is free of judgment and the insistence that everything is so evil. This description actually just sounds like a kick-ass house party. Food, rum, dancing, man, sounds like a good time to me. Many experts are more inclined to believe these conservative descriptions, especially since they come from people who claim to have known Marie Laveau personally. So, at a voodoo ceremony in New Orleans in the 19th century, it's fair to say that you could expect some blessings, some dancing, a whole lot of music, and even more food. As for the group sex, well, depends who you ask. Now, as I hinted at in the last episode, one of the things that seemed to worry the authorities most about voodoo ceremonies was the multiracial character of these events. Voodoo was often slandered as the superstition of ignorant slaves, or it was characterized as something deeply black or African. But reports of voodoo rituals always mention that the crowds of followers are from different ethnic backgrounds. Even in the sensational A Night with the Voodoos, Professor D notes that there are a number of white and mixed-race people in attendance. The description of Marie Laveau's ceremonies from the Louisiana Writers Project make it clear that most of the people who participated in voodoo rites at the St. Anne Cottage were white people. So despite the popular conception, this was not simply a religion for dark-skinned people. It was certainly a religion where black and mixed-race people had power, but in the 19th century, white Louisianans were just as likely to be followers as were black slaves. Now, in the 1850s, in the run-up to the Civil War, laws regulating the slave population and restricting interaction between different racial groups really started to tighten up. As such, the police started to regularly raid and bust up voodoo rituals. For example, in the summer of 1850, a group of women were arrested in New Orleans while taking part in a voodoo ritual near Lake Pontchartrain. Now, this group of women was mostly made up of free women of color, but there were a handful of slaves with them. Now, interestingly, this group, led by the free women of color, ended up suing the police. They claimed that they had been unlawfully detained and denied their freedom of religion. This voodoo trial garnered a ton of attention, but the trial ended up being kind of a drab affair, at least according to the newspapers. You see, the newspaper writers were really hoping that voodoo itself was going to be put on trial. But that's not what this case came down to. Instead, the whole thing hinged on the right of the police to disrupt mixed-race gatherings. The real question was, can free women of color hang out with slave women? The court ultimately decided that they could not, and that the police were within their rights to disrupt these meetings. This touched off a series of arrests that summer and in the ensuing years. At least two incidences where local law enforcement disrupted voodoo ceremonies on the grounds that they were keeping the races apart, at least two of these incidences involved Marie Laveau. In 1850, the papers reported that Marie Laveau was suing a local watchman who she accused of stealing her statue of the Virgin Mary during one of these raids. Now, we don't get too many more details from that particular article, but I personally find it really cool that at this moment in New Orleans history, free women of color felt empowered enough to sue the police. I mean, here we have two separate examples of free women of color involved in voodoo suing the cops. I mean, considering where the history of the South would go, that's worth noting. The next time Marie Laveau would appear in the papers would be 9 years later in 1859, when, once again, one of her voodoo rituals had been busted up on the grounds that she was hosting an event that promoted racial mixing. However, in this case, it seems like she was ratted out by a neighbor. The Daily Picayune reported, quote, "Marie and her wenches were continuously disturbing the peace and that of the neighborhood with their fighting and obscenity and infernal singing and yelling in the hellish observance of the mysterious rites of voodoo, one of the worst forms of African paganism," end quote. But even though this article also seems to lean into the Africanness of voodoo and the hellish nature of this religious worship, ultimately, that's not what ran them afoul of the authorities. In the eyes of antebellum law, black magic was always a secondary concern compared to the worrying mixing of people. One can't help but wonder if all the bad press that voodoo garnered in the 19th century wasn't simply an expression of a deeper anxiety. An anxiety about the mixed nature of New Orleans society. An anxiety that racial boundaries that reinforced the institution of slavery were on the verge of melting away unless they were rigorously policed. Now, to be fair, I'm editorializing here, but this theme just keeps popping up again and again in the research for this topic. But, as always, the politics of race are deeply complex. You see, there have been many that have wanted to present Marie Laveau as a symbol of freedom, black empowerment, and resistance to racial segregation. And indeed, there are many things in her story that support that idea. However, there are some other things that complicate it. Take, for example, the fact that Marie Laveau was a slave owner. Yeah, I know, surprising. Allow me to explain. Not long after the disappearance of Marie Laveau's first husband, Jacques Perry, sometime in the 1820s, Marie Laveau found a new partner. This was a white man named Christophe Glapion. Now, the two weren't legally married. However, they were domestic partners, co-parents, and they lived together in Marie Laveau's cottage on St. Anne Street. Now, Marie Laveau sometimes gets described as Christophe Glapion's place. You might remember from our last episode that placage was a type of mixed-race mistress arrangement that was very specific to Louisiana. But in this case, the relationship between Marie Laveau and Christophe Glapion was more reminiscent of a traditional marriage. Calling her just a place doesn't quite sum up the nature of their relationship. Now, the legend is that the two had 15 children together. That seems to be completely untrue. Researchers have only ever found records of 7 children. Still, you know, that's a lot of kids. Now, records also show that over the course of their relationship, Laveau and Glapion bought and sold 8 slaves. Now, I should note here that in this period, it was actually quite common for wealthy, free people of color to own slaves. The Laveau-Glapion family was no exception. Some researchers have found this fact about Marie Laveau particularly hard to understand. Many of those who described Laveau to the Louisiana Writers Project spoke of her as a champion of the underdog. Even the white-run newspapers had admitted in her obituary that she had been a friend to the sick and had ministered to men on death row. She was consistently described as charitable. Some said that she brought abandoned children into her house, many of whom were black. So it seems weirdly inconsistent that she owned slaves. This has led some to speculate that maybe she bought slaves specifically to help them escape slavery. Some researchers, like Martha Ward, have even speculated that the St. Anne Street cottage, the Laveau-Glapion home, may have been a southern terminal of the Underground Railroad. Now, the evidence for this is pretty slim, But the author Denise Alvarado has pointed out some oral traditions that speak of Marie Laveau creating charms and gris-gris bags specifically to help slaves who are trying to escape bondage. Alvarado has also guessed that maybe Marie Laveau allowed her partner, Glapion, to continue buying slaves because, you know, it was a good cover. No one would expect a pair of slave owners of helping free some slaves. The best piece of evidence, according to Denise Alvarado, that Marie Laveau was involved in the Underground Railroad actually comes from that Louisiana Writers Project interview I mentioned earlier, the one with Charles Raphael, where he describes Marie Laveau's altar. In that description, Raphael mentioned that Marie Laveau had a statue of St. Peter and a statue of St. Maron. Remember, St. Maron was the patron saint of runaway slaves. Alvarado has suggested that this is a clue. This little symbol suggests that Marie Laveau's sympathies lay with the abolitionist movement. That little statue of Saint Maron was there to send a message to any slave that came into her home. When they saw Saint Maron, they knew that Marie Laveau would help them. Now, it's clear that Denise Alvarado really wants to believe the best about Marie Laveau. And honestly, I do too. But taking one man's faded memory of a Saint Maron statue and turning it into evidence that Marie Laveau was part of the Underground Railroad, that's a bit of a stretch. And to be fair to Denise Alvarado, she just throws it out there like here's a possibility. She's not saying that 100% this is the truth. The historian Carolyn Merrill Long, by contrast, has pointed out that the archival record very clearly shows that Marie Laveau did not free any of the people she owned as slaves. All of those people were bought, used, and sold by the Laveau-Glapion household. If she was helping people get free, she didn't help any of those people get free. Now, she may have had a change of heart after the death of Christophe Glapion in the mid-1850s. We know that she did not buy or sell any more human beings after her partner died. So perhaps it was always Glapion who had been more invested in owning slaves than Marie Laveau. But once again, we're just speculating. But I think we need to resist the urge to explain away the contradictions in the lives of historical figures. It would be more neat and tidy if Marie Laveau, champion of the sick and condemned, had also been an active member of the Underground Railroad. But human beings often aren't that neat and tidy. One human being can do things that are both admirable and upsetting. It's indisputable that Marie Laveau owned slaves. It's also clear that she was a deeply humane person who cared for many of society's outcasts. Those things shouldn't go together, but the human experience teaches us otherwise. Marie Laveau's voodoo rituals clearly pushed racial boundaries and brought together people the law would have separated. And she also owned slaves. It's a mash of contradictions, but people are often a mash of contradictions. But with all that said, I still feel like we've only examined a small part of Marie Laveau's complicated character. This story gets even more twisty. You see, there are some that believe that Marie Laveau lived far longer than the newspapers report. There are some that say that she remained looking young and vibrant even as she neared her 80th birthday. There are still others that think that Marie Laveau wasn't just one person. Some think that two people shared one life. How's that for some voodoo? Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will conclude this trilogy on Marie Laveau. Before we go this week, as always, I gotta give some shout-outs, so here they come. Big ups to George Solovey, to Chris Willoughby, to David, to Brian Anderson, to Patricia H. Erb, to Tate Griebel, to Samantha Sevier, or Seaver, Sevier, to Bex, to Shashank, to Stuart Hall, to Hugzu, to Sandra Peterson, to Lucy Adam, to Colin Blossingame, to Aaron Dodge, and to Diana. I'd also like to shout out Angelo Hiras and Dale Taylor, but I'd also like to give a very special shout out to Leslie Mason, or Masson, I hope I've said that correctly, because Leslie has been an amazing supporter for quite some time now, and she has not got the shout out she deserves. So Leslie, you rule. In fact, all of you rule. You are all beautiful human beings. All the names you just heard are people that have decided to support at $5 or more every month on Patreon. And honestly, I really could not do this without you guys. Thanks to everyone that's supporting at all levels on Patreon. If you think Patreon might be for you, go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and check out all the awesome extras that you get when you sign up for Patreon. There is so much extra stuff now. It's a good time to be a patron of Our Fake History. So, you know, check it out. If you want to get in touch with me, you can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Facebook. That's facebook.com/ourfakehistory. Or you can catch me on Twitter at ourfakehistory. As always, the theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And before we go today, I'm going to be playing a brand new song from Dirty Church's brand new EP, The Last Supper EP. This song is called Eraser. Now, all the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.